Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred in Little Steven's Underground Garage with your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today I'm speaking with Elvis Costello. His new album is titled The Boy Named If, and it features our recent coolest song in the world, Farewell OK. We'll listen to some of that now, and then I'll be back with my interview with Elvis Costello on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and we've got a very special guest today for your Coolest Conversations. Joining me is singer, songwriter, and producer Elvis Costello. Hey, how are you, Elvis?
Good to hear your voice. Good,
thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah. Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, you were married to Diana Krall, the jazz musician, right?
I am married to her.
Okay, and you guys have got a couple of teenage boys.
We do. Yeah.
That's so how was life for the pandemic with a couple of teenagers?
You know, they've been the strength of it all. There's some activity going on in every room in our house, and you know, we come together at the end of the day and sit around and have our parliament around supper. Everybody's got something to say, and there's a lot of fantastic ideas going around. A lot of great music. A lot of great. You know, they have different music they listen to. Diana and I have a lot of this. We listen to a lot of the same music, more than people would imagine. She has wild taste in music, plays a lot of secret stuff that people don't know she can do. And so, you know, there'd be more surprises if you knew who were the wild people in our house. You might not imagine who they are. You know, yeah.
What's something that Diana would play that would just blow my mind that we wouldn't expect?
Well, I think the, you know, 2020, I, you know, when all of this began, all of this confinement and being together, which has been, I have to say, for myself, you worry about your friends and family far away in any circumstances of crisis. But, you know, for me, it was only great to have all this time together, because one of us is usually out on the road. That's how we make our living. As you know, that's what we do. We're suddenly all in the one place together, and we're finding ways to make music now. Just before that all happened, both Diana and I left to have a little recording adventure separate to each other. I went to Helsinki, and with just a guitar and a rhythm mace, and made some sort of rock and roll records that I couldn't have made with the Imposters. She went to Miami to make a record with Iggy Pop. and some guy called Thomas Dutronc, who's a French singer whose mother is Francois Zadi. Charles Dutronc is his father, who's a famous musician as well. Thomas and Iggy were going to do a version of C'est Bon. And as you know, Iggy sings in French. And Diana can, you know, certainly play that music and can sing in French too, being Canadian. And you wouldn't imagine that as a band now, would you?
But, no, not
there
at
you
all.
Go. And when she sent me the picture from Miami of the two of them together, I said, "Yeah, you know, they just need a drummer with straight blonde hair, and they could go out there as some kind of mutant kind of indie, you know, sort of garage band. I don't think anybody would notice the difference. So that wouldn't be. There's right there. At the same time, I've had my adventures with other types of musicians that people didn't immediately expect and even want. But you learn a little bit from everything you do. So I found along the ways that some of the classical musicians that I've learned are the wildest people in imagination. They're not all stuffed shirts by any means. You know, they have some of the biggest dreams. So I try to learn a little bit from everything I've done, and it's all been useful. And then when you pick the electric guitar up again, it's new to you. It tells another story, not the same one as you tell before, but a different one. And that's what the Boy Named If is. One of those moments where I've been doing different things, and then I came back to the thing that I love to do, which is make a noise. But it was a kind of more noise that I meant to make.
Well, let's talk some about The Boy Named If. Our coolest song in the world this week is Farewell Okay. It's off the new album, The Boy Named If, came out this past January. There's like a version of the album that also has got this 88-page hardback storybook. Did the idea of this project predate the pandemic then, as you were describing, or did the album, the book idea arise sort of in the midst of it?
I think there's always ideas sort of circling around your mind. Mm-hmm. Certainly the idea of writing short stories that lead in or lead out of songs is something I've thought about doing for 30 years. I've done it and not published it before. So I know that I knew I could do it. And given the time that I suddenly found myself with, I think we all felt we were all expecting the immediate crisis to pass a little sooner than it did.
Yeah.
If you think about 2020, as I said, I returned home from, we were actually out on the road when things got tough, and it became apparent that we couldn't complete our UK tour. That was in March 2020, came home. I'd been in the studio, as I said, both in Helsinki and in Paris. I looked at that music, and that turned into the album Hey Clock Face, which was a mixture of these clinky clanky rock and roll songs recorded in Finland and some stuff done with the jazz ensemble and Steve Naive in Paris, something I'd always wanted to do, go into a studio in another city and pick up something of the flavor of the way the people play and think there. I did some work with a friend of mine from New York over the internet, you know, using the connections over distance. Mm-hmm. And with that, I learned that there was nothing to fear. There was nothing that was going to hold the music back if you just kept your head on. So by the summer, Sebastian Crusar, producer, and I had been working on, he'd been mixing 5 albums worth of live material for the Armed Forces box set, which came out at the end of 2020. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of listening to those mixes, and, you know, it was great to hear the attractions in all sorts of locations. Christmas in London, a riot in Sydney, Hollywood High School, but none of it was happening in the moment, and I didn't want to live in the past. So I picked up my guitar, and these songs sort of tumbled out very quickly. It was obvious from the get-go they were electric guitar songs. For the most part, they were major key electric guitar songs at that. I love the minor keys. I love a bit of Misery, but they came out kind of bright and rhythmic, and so around that time, Pete Thomas, our drummer, was saying, I don't think we're going to get called back to work anytime soon. What are we going to do? And I said, well, how about this? And sent him one of the songs, and it came back to me in a matter of, it seemed like a matter of minutes, with the drums all just as they should be. And we had a kind of conversation over some of the songs, back and forward, guitar and voice, guitar and drums and voice. Mm-hmm. And then it was very easy for the others to put their I won't say it was easy because they played great, but they, you know, they knew what to do.
Do, yeah.
And we didn't need to be looking at each other and, you know, pulling funny faces. Or we trust each other enough. 45 years, Steve, Pete and I have played together,
right,
off. Davey Farragut, 20 years.
Well, so when in your mind's eye, you could certainly see what their expressions were.
We all know how ugly we are. We don't need to see each other every minute of the day in order to, you know, there's a degree of trust. And you go, like any group, you start out like a bunch of strangers, a bunch of experiences, some of them good, some of them bad. it's like you have that as your foundation. If you go away from each other for a little while, when you come back, that's the thing that experience, you know, joins you together. And then you're doing whatever it is you're doing in that moment. You're not living in the past. So if people go, oh, this sounds just like, and they mention some other record, well, so long as it's a good record, I don't mind that too much, but that's not the way I think about it, you know.
Right.
That's your past. That's your nostalgia. I'm not nostalgic. I'm doing it now. And I think it's very apparent that we were doing it now and we were doing it well. And I knew that right away. Sebastian put it all together, and it certainly doesn't sound like anything timid that was recorded, you know. Some of the isolation records were a little on the timid side, and maybe they reflected the way people felt. I just didn't feel that way. I didn't feel there was anything to be gained by complaining about what was happening. There's many worse things that could be happening than even this. And when you did start to lose friends, as I'm sure all of us did, you know, we would have lost them anyway, but these circumstances brought around their departure, and you couldn't help but find that very difficult. Right. So I didn't think that was a reason to fold up. You know, I think it was a reason to speak up and get going again. And we've been out on the road and played some of these songs before they were released, and they were terrific to play live. So we look forward to the
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about some of the tour dates that you'll be doing in August this year over here. But you mentioned the producer Sebastian Chris a couple of times, and let's think. You mentioned him. We're putting together, was it a reissue of Armed Forces?
Yeah,
right. But you worked with him. Like with the album, was it Look Now? And so you've been working with him several records.
The biggest, most unusual thing that we've done together was Spanish Model, which was a revisiting of the backing tracks of this year's Model from 1978, the Attractions original instrumental parts. And we replaced my vocals, which heaven knows have been the thing that had been holding that record back all these years, and replaced them with a cast of Latin singers. And I've got a whole new group of friends, you know. I mean, some of these people are very, very well established.
Well, what I want to get at here is how did you even start? How did you meet Sebastian? How did you guys start working?
I was working on some dance music down in Miami where he was raised. His family is from Argentina, and like a number of Argentine friends of mine, his family left in those days in the 80s, which were tough times in Argentina with the regime they had there.
Right.
He came to live in Miami, and he's started out in music as in production, in Latin music primarily. He's the Latin Grammy winning producer of the year twice over. There's numerous incredible credits. But he's built a bridge between, you know, Southern Hemisphere musicians that want to come and work in Miami or Los Angeles. He's worked with a lot of the great players down in Miami. I was down there, I say, working on some dance music down there, and we became acquainted, and remained friends. I became friends with some of his friends who were musicians and writers. And over the next years, he was by this point living in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. He was working with Pete Thomas and David Farragher quite a lot, and I got friendly with Marisol from La Santa Cecilia. I sang on one of their records. She sang on one of the tracks of the record I did with The Roots, which was had one verse in Argentine and Spanish, and Marisol sang that, even though she's Mexicana. Little by little, these you know, Pete had played on a Fito Páez record. We'd gone to Buenos Aires nearly 20 years ago now, and Fito had invited us to his house. And you got the feeling that even if you were not in the charts in some of these countries, there were musicians that knew you, you know?
Right.
You know the way it is.
Yeah.
Before there was the internet and everything, everybody could be watching the same television show, and you know, music used to have had a sort of magic to its rarity. I'm not saying, oh, it was better in the old days, because I love being able to hear anything anytime. But there was something that meant that the music went in deep when you heard it 1 hour of one day in a week, And that was the only time you could hear that song, and you had to wait till it came around again. And maybe somebody knew some songs from far away, whether it be from New Orleans or from Memphis or from Detroit or from Nashville or from Bakersfield or from San Francisco. And the same was true of American listeners, both North and South America. They were hearing the signals coming out of Ealing and Liverpool and Newcastle and London, you know, and wondering what that was all about and trying to make their version of it. That's how the world of music goes around.
I agree with all of that. Let me ask you, though, I get focused here on because we need to speak about the track Farewell, okay, because it is our coolest song in the world this week. And to me, it's got a very Little Richard vibe there, especially in the verse driving. Are you much of a Little Richard fan?
It's all about Little Richard. Little Richard is the rock and roll singer, in my opinion. you know, I don't think Richard Costello would have sounded like a good name, and I don't think Little Costello would have been a good name. And I would never be able to sing like Richard. But, you know, I'd heard him, of course. I'm a little too young to have heard his original records when they first came out. But I heard him through Paul McCartney's love of him, I think, probably first. And, you know, when I was a Beatles fan, when I was just like 9 years old, you tended to notice who it was that your favorite singer said were their own favorites. And Richard was obviously, they toured with Little Richard, the Beatles. So, that you know, there are pictures of the Beatles sitting around Little
Right.
Richard.
Oh, I think one story is that, in fact, I saw this on 60 Minutes when I can't remember the name of the correspondent's name, but they asked, they're speaking with Little Richard, and you know, he would say outrageous things, and then he would say something that seemed outrageous but would have a kernel of truth in it. And one of those things was they asked him about the Beatles, and he was like, "Oh yeah, I could have owned the Beatles. I owned the Beatles. The Beatles were for me." And later on, you find out what Brian Epstein had.
But it kind of reached out. You can see how that made sense in his logic. You know,
right? Like, absolutely.
I did a TV show once in London. It was the David Letterman show, actually. They used to do those weeks from other cities occasionally. Uh-huh. And they came to London to do the show, and I was on the show with the late edition attractions. James Burton and Mark Rebo on guitar, in addition to me on guitar. So we had two lead guitar players, very contrasting guitar players, and we were doing Bamalama Bamaloo, because I had cut it for a record. I'd just gone into Eddie Grant's studio in Barbados, and I'd cut this album of songs I'd loved all my life. It wasn't anything serious. It was supposed to be fun. You know, to cut other people's songs was a celebratory record. It was a lot to do with, you know, driving to work every day, trying to stay out of a ditch and drink some rum punch, play some rock and roll, and then come home. You know, yeah. 5 years later, the Warner Brothers put it out as if it was a real record, and I wanted it to come out and just arrive in the racks with no announcement, but I couldn't persuade them to do that. So I had the idea it would be fun to suddenly find, hey, one of the people you like was singing their favorite songs, because that's how I learned everything off record. So I wanted to replicate that. And we cut Bamalama Bamaloo. I was screaming myself hoarse trying to sing like Richard. And then I get on this TV show in London, and they tell me, you know, occasionally, do you recall, they would, and they still see it today on the Tonight Show, occasionally somebody will sit in with the house band.
Right.
And sitting in with the house band, with the Paul Schaefer house band that night on the Letterman in London, was Chuck Berry and Little Richard.
Wow.
No pressure, you know. And without telling us that we were booked to do Bamalama Bamaloo. And Richard came on the set as we were finishing the rehearsal, and he was so funny. He was like, "You're singing my song." And he was like, really, he was completely, you know. Chuck was scary. You know, I saw him come and open the door for him. I didn't even try to engage with him. I just figured, no, he's a man on a mission here. He's come to play. I don't think this is the time to have a conversation with him. But
yeah,
Richard was absolutely delightful. Yeah. So, yes, I would say you're quite right. There's got a little bit of, you know, if we were old enough to have gone to Hamburg, this is what we would have been playing in the Große Freiheit.
Yeah, I've also, the you know, your lyrics always are great, great turns of phrase and imagery. And that song, I heard the Little Richard kind of progression going on. I was listening to the lyrics and, you know, lines like about the mascara cry and yeah. thought you'd change the little humble. I was thinking, oh, this has got to be, he's got to be singing about Little Richard here.
Yeah, well, it's going on in a dance hall. I mean, I used to go to the dance hall with my father and he was, and this was just in the afternoon, but you could get the flavor of it even as a kid. I used to go Saturday afternoons with my father to get, my mother to get, mother wanted me out of the house. I go to work with my dad and sit up in the balcony and watch the dance band he sang with. They weren't singing any rock and roll music. They were singing, you know, like strict dance music. But you got the flavor of it. It was kind of a, like to be 9, 8 or 9, 10 years old and sitting in a dance hall in the dark, even in the afternoon, had a feeling of something like, well, when I get older, I'll be able to come here. It's going to be good. You know, it smells kind of strange. And I guess it was beer and perspiration and old perfume. And there was people like learning to dance down on the dance floor. Like there would sometimes be a mother teaching their daughter to dance by putting them up on their feet. You know, they would pick the kid right. up, put it on their feet and then show them the dance steps. And you'd get like two little old ladies dancing together. Who didn't have partners, and then you get people who were professional or competition dancers, and they'd play the Latin music, such as it was, and I suppose it was very authentic. My father would play the conga, and sometimes sing in Spanish, and they would do some pasodoble or cha-cha-cha or tango, and these dancers would practice their steps. You know, it's kind of a glimpse through the curtain of what right. might be going on a little later. And I always kept it in my mind. And I think that the words of Farewell OK, although they tumble by very fast, are all the accumulation of that view from the age of being a child looking at it to when I was in the same dance hall when I was 25, on stage in that same dance hall where my dad had gone to work every night for 20 years. And singing from the stage and looking out at our crowd who looked somewhat different, you know, and this was, you know, I guess by then about 1983. But it was still the same kind of things going on, the same mischief was going on, the same lies, the same tears,
right?
The same embraces, the same fights, you know, it's all just going on every night.
So the full album of the full title of the album, The Boy Named If and Other Children's Stories. Yeah. Is that right? Okay. Farewell OK is one of these children's stories then, this 9-year-old going to the dance hall. And so if is a nickname for an imaginary friend, what was your proper name of your imaginary friend? Or did you have several?
I never had one, I think. Pardon me. I was brought up Catholic, so I believed I had a guardian angel. So, I mean, I didn't need an imaginary friend. I already had, they was getting crowded in my room, you know,
Well, did your guardian angel have a name?
No. I mean, I always thought that was a bit odd, that idea, even when I was, a lot of things I was taught, you know, were a bit odd. but they also had mystery. And I think given that a lot of what we were singing in church was in another language, it was like when some of my English friends started to kind of pick up Eastern spiritual patterns and want to have mantras and things like that in the late 60s, I never went with any of that. Because when I was being a kid, I'd been taught to sing plain song Latin. I could sing a whole mass in Latin. I didn't understand one word of what I was saying, but there was something hypnotic about it. So I didn't really need any kind of other kind of chanting thing. I already knew where to go for that. I'd sort of found everything I could find out about that. And different kinds of meditative music come and go in your life. I think there's times when you need to be still and listen to quiet music, and there's times where you want to throw yourself around the room or shout your head off about something you care about, and that's why we write, you know. When I came to write these songs, I was thinking of all these different scenes that mark sort of growing up, although you get to the point where you're still, your chronological age is whatever it is, that people are still telling you to stop acting like a child. You know, so I thought the deception of the imaginary friend, if it is a deception, or the fantasy of the imaginary friend, is the same thing as the alibi you make when you're 25 or 37 for your bad behavior. And there would be something funny that could live in rock and roll songs. You know, I don't want to be necessarily writing. I'm a writer, you know, I get to travel and invent people out of composites of people I've known, some people I've even loved, some of them even myself, and then but you know, I'm not usually writing my every word of my diary as in my life today. I never was doing that. I was always imagining other things. I think that's part of the joy of being a writer, is you get to travel and enter worlds, and you speak in voices of characters, you kill them off, just as they do in detective fiction, and nobody takes you to jail. You know, there's all sorts of wonderful things. None of them are being like God, you know, but you move the pieces around the toy theater of your mind, and something happens. And if you don't get too serious about it and you move it around with rhythmic music, that's called rock and roll, I think, you know, because that music has always been a collision of different styles. And it can be any collision. You know, I don't hold with the orthodoxy of rock and roll that it must only be this. It must only be these three or four chords. It needn't be. If the attitude is right, it can be much more complex, or it could all be on one chord. You know, a lot of music I love is on one chord.
Right. I think a lot of James Brown stuff's on.
Yeah, it never gets off the one, and you never miss it. Or he delays, and it's that thing that it's driving you crazy by the time they take it to the bridge. That's exactly what's so fantastic about that kind of music. And you hear that in lots of great music from all sorts of places in the world, where people are in a complete hypnotic flow, singing about something that matters.
I want to ask you about
joy or faith or loss, or it's not a whole bunch of topics that we sing about. With the way we sing about them is what gives them that magic and that individuality. You know, that's what I love.
We mentioned you're talking about the different characters, and I wanted to ask you about one of the characters you had created here on the album. In My Most Beautiful Mistake, there's not only actress but sort of the director. Did any one actress inspire that?
No, I was thinking more of somebody that kind of like, you know, I was thinking more about the vanity of the writer. Mm-hmm. So I guess that would be part of that would be a version of me, you know, moving all of these pieces about. But I like the idea of, you know, this guy struggling with
the one hit wonder.
Yeah, the one hit wonder, the Crown Prince of Geniusville, as he's referred. I mean, the short story that accompanies that song, you know, sort of gives a little bit more substance to the character, and he's definitely a fellow who's had a moment of brief fame, and now he's seeking a spark of inspiration, and he thinks he sees it in the face of this woman who's serving him supper in this canteen, and of course she's heard all these lies before, and the whole story is then becomes a mystery tale as to whether everything that's happening between them is a seduction, or whether it's all actually a scene in the film he's written. That's what I leave to the listener to sort out. You know, I love songs like that have a bit of a whodunit kind of aspect to them, where you stick with them and the music keeps you moving forward, hopefully. And Nicole Atkins came in on to sing the vocal part with me. And having her voice, she doesn't take individual lines so many, she takes one, but she's singing with me, and it just had the tone of her voice kind of added something to the comprehension of the lyric, I think. She sings great on it, lights it up, you know, she's a terrific singer. So she's going to open up a couple of shows for us in June. Nick Lowe is on the bill on most of the shows. Nicole and whatever instrumentation she's got with her is going to open up about four shows. She's hopefully going to sing with us in the show when she's there, so we get to do that tune My Most
Oh,
Beautiful
good.
Mistake.
Good.
It's one of my favorites on that album, and I think a few other people have said that. So, you know, we got the chance to bring out Magnificent Hurt, Farewell OK, Penelope, Hate Me, Death of Magic Thinking, What If I Can't Give You Anything But Love. We got to bring those out in front of the audience back in October 2021 before anybody even knew The Boy Named Diff was coming out or even existed. So we knew right away that those songs could hit without anybody knowing what they were about. Mistook Me for a Friend was also in the set. So we now have that. We're in that different period now where people have maybe had the record for a couple of weeks and they've got their favorites from it, or they've listened and they know what the stories are about, and they think about the songs differently now because they have that knowledge, you know?
Right.
And so
yeah,
we'll put a show together that tries to bring the best out of everything.
Well, let's talk some about this now. Mentioned Nick Lowe. So in August, you're doing a bunch of shows here in the US, and Nick Lowe is also on the bill most of these shows, I think, and he's being backed by the instrumental band Lost Straitjackets, and we're big fans here in the Underground Garage of both of those artists.
They're great. You know, I love hearing Nick. Nick, bear in mind, Nick's my hero, you know?
Well,
Nick,
I'm going to ask you about all that.
I mean,
I know you've been a fan of his since his Brinsley Schwartz days, right?
Yeah. I mean, Nick is my teenage hero in a different sense than the way I felt about John Lennon or Levi Stubbs or Rick Danko or Joni Mitchell or anybody that, you know, I listened to in the dark, David Ackles, you know, these people that I learned all this music from. Nick was somebody who could actually go up and talk to. You know, he was actually playing in Liverpool when I was living in Liverpool in 72. I'd been in a band for 2 years. We were just playing around pubs and wherever they'd let us, me and my pal Alan Mays. And we would sing Nick Lowe songs. And the good thing about singing Nick Lowe songs is they weren't terribly well known. So we would never mention, we wouldn't always mention that he'd written them. We'd let people believe that we'd written them. You know, they would hear like Surrender to the Rhythm or something and think, that's a good song. And we just let them believe, you know. And I learned a lot from Nick and the Brinsleys. You know, I heard Wonder Woman by Alan Toussaint as they did it.
Uh-huh.
I'm Ahead If I Could Quit While I'm Behind by Jim Ford, who wrote Nikki Hokie, and a bunch of terrific songs like Point of No Return, you know, that Bobby Womack did. And they did the same thing, though. You have to say, this is where I learned this trick, was the Brinsleys wouldn't make a speech before they sang songs. They'd sing like a Chris Kenner song.
Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't always let on who, they just left it to their crowd to look up who'd written those songs they did.
Right.
So if they did, you know, I Have Cried My Last Tear, which is another Alan Toussaint song, you'd have to find out that was on the B-side of a Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers record. And of course it was originally, I forget who cut the original version. Maybe.
Well, Elvis, I have to say about that, what I've discovered is I play some song and get off stage and some guy comes up to me, he's so excited about this particular song. And then, and I'm excited that they've made this connection with the song. And then I say, oh yeah, that song was done by so-and-so, so-and-so. And then, you know, sometimes they're elated by that, but more often than not, they're like disappointed. It's like, oh, that's not your song. It's like, well, I mean, it's our interpretation.
I mean, you can see this disappointment.
It's like, oh, so somehow it's not as great because it's not our song.
Well, I never felt weird. That. I think the thing is, maybe I'm just the way we felt in England. There's two or three people. Georgie Fame was one of them.
Yeah.
But because I was so young when I heard him, and I just dug the way he sounded and the way looked and the way he played the organ and everything. And he did different kinds of tunes to nearly all the other singers. Everybody, all the other singers in all the English bands, who particularly the piano or organ players, all wanted to be Ray Charles. Understandably, you know, why wouldn't you want to do that, you know? So you listen to the way they sing, you can hear the influence, right? Gary Brooker, Joe Cocker, Stevie Winwood, Stevie Marriott, all coming from Ray Charles in some way or other. Georgie Fame, It's come from Mose Allison, John Hendricks.
Yeah.
You know, Eddie Jefferson and Gene McDaniels. And it's just a whole different deck of cards. Now, in a different kind of way, like early 70s, Nick Lowe, they'd been, you know, they'd been a pop band, they'd been a psychedelic band, they'd been a kind of hippie get together and country band. When I first met Nick, he kind of had, you know, he was already kind of sporting a shorter haircut. And like, I think, what's that about? He looks like a mod. You know, and the rest of the band had beards and everything, but Nick looked like a mod. And it was weird, you know, because in my teenage mind, all of that didn't go together. And I realized that there was nothing to fear. And I think particularly when you're a kid, you tend to pick music up and put it down because your friends don't necessarily go along with it. You know, mm-hmm. You go, oh, you can't possibly like that music, can you? That's so old fashioned, meaning it came out last year.
Right.
And then when you go back and listen to it again, you go, you know what? I was right the first time. Shall I tell you something? Lee Dorsey is hipper than Yes.
It just say that again.
I said Lee Dorsey is hipper than Yes, you know, and Leonard Bernstein is hipper than Nice, you know. It's great that Keith Emerson wanted to do America, but you know what's a wilder piece of music? America in the score of West Side Story, because it doesn't need to be beaten up like that on the organ to be wild. It already was wild.
Yeah,
you know. Cool. You know, it was wild, and the words are wild as well. You know. So yeah, that's what I learned as time went on is don't get hipped out of, you know, by your friends telling you, oh, you can't like that music. And I'm going, yeah, I can. and it was people like Nick, you know, and being able to talk to him and him being so down to earth and just have a beer with him in the pub in Matthew Street opposite the Cavern where they were playing, that made it feel like, hey, I could be in a band like this maybe if I get good, you know. And couple of years later, I went to London, started out, and the band didn't work out, but I got the experience of playing, and then that's how I ended up making records. And who was producing them but Nick? You know, so I've known him professionally since from the get-go, when I was 22, when I signed to Stiff, you know.
And but so he was on Stiff at the same time?
Well, he was the founder. Stiff. Jake Riviera became my manager, and Dave Robinson, who was the manager of Vintage Sports.
Right.
You know, Nick was the first artist on the label and the house producer. So, I mean, it sounds grand. It makes him sound like he was Jerry Wexler or something. But we were recording in this little 8-track studio in North London, and they just shoved me in there to make demos, and they shoved me in there with initially the drummer from Clover and Nick playing bass, John McPhee, who's now in the Doobie Brothers. And then they realized that maybe there was more to me as a singer than I think at first they thought I was just a songwriter, you know, because I looked kind of weird. And but everybody looked kind of weird.
Right. Well, let me ask you still, I want to stay focused here. This whole, the Nick. Yeah. So you already had this relationship with him before. I mean, you had spoken with him, hung out with him some, and now you come into Stiff and there he is smiling and saying, hey, you know, hey, Declan, or hey, Elvis, let's start recording. I mean, what was your feeling then? He must have been pretty elated. He must have felt like he'd arrived, right?
Yeah, there's only two people who are professional musicians that I can think of that call me Declan. And that's my former partner, Alan Mays, from the group Rusty, from Liverpool, from 71 to 73. And Nick, because Nick knew me before I was, you know, had this absurd alias. And I never really thought about it. You know, I was DP Costello when I first came to Stiff. I was using my initials and my great-grandmother's name, Costello, Irish name. You know, they added this Elvis thing. And if you think about, like, how crazy names were in 1976, 77 in London, you know, Johnny Rotten, Captain Sensible, Reckless Eric, who was on the label too, horrible little fellow, but, you know, had a couple of songs.
I think it's in the grand tradition of English rock and roll, right? Billy Fury and Marty Wilde.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, Listen to this. I mean, the same manager named all of the people in early in the rock and roll. Georgie Fame, who was the piano player in Billy Fury's band, Billy Fury, a great Liverpool rock and roll singer.
Right.
Marty Wilde, Johnny Gentle, Vince Eager, Duffy Power. Are we sensing a theme here?
Yes.
And it was a little bit unusual the way they kind of named everybody with these kind of very sort of high camp names, you know, that they had these, because I don't think it was really very easy for those fellows to inhabit the kind of rock and roll in the same way as everybody imagined Elvis. You know, he seemed like a creature from another planet. And I mean, Marty, I know his daughter Kim, and I've met Marty. He was a really great guy. He worked the clubs with my dad in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And he's a wonderful chap, and Kim also, terrific rock and roll singer, terrific pop singer, Kim, and her brother Ricky. I mean, it's a little different because we learned it from a book. We learned rock and roll from a book or a magazine or a record. You couldn't go to a club and hear the originators of the music that you love so much. So you heard it like done by somebody from art school, you know. I'm glad that they existed, but it makes it different. And when you had somebody like Georgie Fame, who was sort of a conduit to a whole bunch of music that you couldn't otherwise have come across at the age of 10, or later on when I was 17, to hear Nick and the Brinsleys playing these esoteric songs out of New Orleans, how in the world would I have known those songs? I mean, in the same way as the Birds, you know, Know You Love, you know, they introduced a bunch of different ideas into pop records. They put a different kind of electricity behind Dylan songs. They brought,
right,
you know, sort of, you know, drone things out of that they'd heard in Coltrane and tried to put them in 3-minute pop records. That was a tremendous imagination. Then they made Sweetheart of the Rodeo. And it was a complete shock to somebody who had followed them, their records through the 60s, to get to 68 and hear Sweetheart of the Rodeo. But as you say, when people come up to you and say, "What's that song?" That "What's that song?" was by Merle Haggard or the Leuven Brothers. How would I have heard the Leuven Brothers living in Liverpool? There's no way I would have heard. But hearing them via the Birds made me curious about them and led me down the path. And then when it came my turn to do something similar, I cut a Little Richard song or I cut a George Jones song. I had somebody come up to me and say, "You know what? I'd never heard George Jones until I heard you sing Good Year for the Roses." So even if I could never sing it half as well as George, I did some sort of good service because now that person knows George Jones is, you know.
Well, you know, you also did good service for Nick when you did a version of What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. Because yeah, that really,
Curtis Stigers did even bigger service to him because he sang it in the Bodyguard soundtrack that sold 8 million records.
well, still, you know, I guess,
I think that this was the foundation of Nick's gentleman balladeer period.
Yeah,
you know, because he obviously it was a great thing. Any one or half a dozen or a dozen or more Nick Lowe songs could have been a multi-million selling hit record by somebody, even him. You know, I mean, because he's a killer singer, great bass player, and it's all the rest of it's just luck. And what you have the hit on, you can't predict.
Yeah.
You know, so it was great. Yeah, we did it with the Attractions. It ended up being part of the American issue of Armed Forces. I never thought of it as part of that album because we didn't cut it for the album originally. And then, you know, of course, it was picked up and made. People heard that song and it. In the context of a Whitney Houston album, and it was huge success for Nick, and I think Nick's written some of his most beautiful songs because he didn't have to pursue cheap pop success with his music. He could write totally from the heart.
Right.
He had a little foundation of some reward from that one very big hit. And if you think about the songs that he's written in the last 30 years, there's some of the most beautiful ballads. I'm a Mess. I mean, that's as good as anything Dan Penn ever wrote. you know, and that's the highest compliment I can pay anybody.
Why did you cover What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding?
You see, when I heard it first, it was on a record called The New Favorites of Brinsley Schwartz.
Brinsley Schwartz, right.
And it was the cover of the record was made, had a big sign, you know, big, like a fake up neon sign that made it look like it was a greatest hits album, but it was actually an album of new songs. And I think I'm right in saying that there was an element of satire in Nick's writing of Peace, Love, and Understanding. I think he was sort of satirizing the kind of Tin Pan Alley bandwagon jumping aspect of songwriters going, what are the kids into today? Oh, they're into peace and love. Let's write about peace and love. Right. So there was a little bit of tongue in cheek in the Brinsley's version. And I thought, what about if we just treated it like it was, let's play it like it was Born to Run. You know, let's play it like it's the most desperate thing, edge of the cliff thing that we know how to do. Do you know what I mean? Like that Born to Run has that, you know, that song Born to Run?
You're speaking of the Bruce Springsteen song Born to Run.
Yeah. You know the way that feels, you know?
Yeah. A lot of the desperation.
The desperation to get somewhere. And I thought, what about if we sang it, like we play it full on like that. So I think that was kind of like, and we were in America by then. We'd been to America and we'd seen how far we were from like our little kind of rinky-dink sound, you know, those first couple of records. Wasn't going to get across on American radio, not with all that Fleetwood Mac stuff clogging up,
right.
You know, and the Eagles. So I think we thought maybe we could hit them harder with something, and that would be a simple, and heaven knows, a sentiment that we'll never get old, sadly, you know. And I've heard Nick sing it as a lament in years past, in his solo shows. And, you know, he's come up and sung it with us on occasion, and we've gone at it like 100 miles an hour. I've sung it with lots of different people, and it's always a good song to sing. And like I say, sadly, it's always right on time. But with irony now, you know. So I'm glad that we cut it. And, you know, Nick and I, he obviously produced those first five records, I think, and then Blood and Chocolate, which was the last record The Attraction should have made. And he played bass on Mighty Like a Rose. He played bass on half of Brutal Youth. The better half of it, I have to say, in terms of rock and roll, is Nick on bass. The ballads are pretty great with The Attractions, but the rock and roll songs are the ones that Nick or I play on.
All right.
Kind of Murder's way more rocking than the songs with the four Attractions on it, you know.
I thought it was interesting you mentioned a moment ago about Born to Run and Springsteen's Desperation, because I know that, well, what was it, back in 77, you and The Attractions, you wind up on Saturday Night Live, and that spot should have gone to Sex Pistols, their visas didn't work out, and then against the wishes of the record company, you don't play Less Than Zero, but you play Radio, and then whether you were banned from Saturday Night Live, they just didn't ask you back until many years later. In hindsight, everybody agrees that you did the right.
There was some anger,
right?
You'll never work on, you know, you'll never work on American TV again, kind of thing, shouted in anger, because you know they're doing a show, and you got to appreciate that we were full of ourselves. We'd been around the country. We'd had that initial. We'd realized the scale of the task we'd taken on, because we didn't just, unlike the other wimpier bands out of London, you know, we did the miles. The English bands of our generation didn't do the miles. That's why they came in, they'd come in and play a club in New York, and they think they'd conquered America, you know. And we immediately, our first show was in San Francisco, our second show was in the Whiskey a Go-Go, our third show was in Jed's in New Orleans. Then we drove to Atlanta and played second on the bill to the Talking Heads, and then drove to Madison, Wisconsin. You know, we were doing the miles.
When you said you went from Atlanta to Madison, Wisconsin, there weren't shows in between.
No.
No, that's
I don't think so. I think
Atlanta to Madison, that's
I remember stopping in Louisville and having a steak because I still ate that stuff then.
Yeah, Louisville is
And
at least Louisville's 10 hours solid driving from at least
yeah.
10 hours from Atlanta.
I know that we I don't know that we played in between. Somebody could correct me on this, but I believe we played at Atlanta. It wasn't a very long tour. It was all in a couple of weeks, but it was a lot of miles, and it gave us that immediate sense. It was the first time I ever went to Nashville. We got
Yeah.
as far as the outskirts. We were trying to buy beer, and it was Sunday, and we couldn't find anywhere that we would sell us beer. So we had to drive into Nashville to find a bar that was open. And so we just drove in past the city limits, found a bar that was open, and had a few beers. They wouldn't sell us liquor, only sell beer this place. And then we got back on the road, and then we drove somewhere else. I remember waking up in the morning in the mountains, listening to the radio broadcast, the local radio telling the communities which schools were closed because of the snow, and it was
Yeah.
like really another world. It wasn't like driving from Oldham to, Hartlepool in England. It was really like a dream. That we were, you suddenly we were just in this rattling around the five of us in this station wagon. It's the kind of experience that most American musicians have. They have the
Yeah.
places are far apart. The country's vast, and I think as the way everything that we came across, all of the endearments, all of the road signs, all of the names of the emporiums and clubs, all sounded like the beginning of song titles. In some cases, they were, and like the Quisling Clinic. Was an actual clinic in Madison, Wisconsin. It's now an apartment building. And of course, when I read that, I was thinking about this song about, the whole fear of a return to a right-wing kind of ideology that had held in the 40s and the 30s and 40s. And when I heard the word Quisling, I could only hear it connected to the infamous Quisling, the Norwegian collaborator during the Second World War. So I made up a whole fantasy around that in a and that somewhere in my notebook is that verse hasn't it's not no it was never intended as a insult to the people of Wisconsin. It was just like a transpose. You see what I did? I was like, that's
Right.
how you transpose as a writer. You transpose it into your dream, your nightmare. So America was filled with those images because it was also strange. But it also gave us an idea of what we needed to do musically next in order to hit. We hadn't, bear in mind, when we came to America the first time, we hadn't finished recording this year's model. So we went back in the studio a week after we got back and finished the album. And I'm sure those tracks were informed by just having played in America, not that we knew everything. But it gave us a different attitude,
Right, and experiences. And so the reason I even started in on that the Saturday Night Live thing was because the Bruce Springsteen connection to the song to Radio Radio, which I believe began as Radio Soul. Is that right? And
That's
so,
right.
and I think it's interesting that you were really into Springsteen at this early on, and you took inspiration to come up with an initial version
I think
of
I
the
wrote that song.
song.
I think I wrote that song first. What year is Born to Run? Is it 74 or 75?
75, yeah.
I mean, I was going around telling people about Bruce Springsteen, like the way you would whisper about some great underground band. And I heard those first songs, particularly the romantic songs, although they were rock and roll songs, they're tremendously romantic. The songs like Sandy and The Wild Innocent and the myth spinning. They talk mythically about people. And I wanted to write something like that. And so I wrote this song called Radio Soul, which was about literally, I mean, it's kind of a more spiritual idea about the radio inside everybody that's broadcasting, But it was ill-formed and it was shamelessly indebted to Bruce's earlier records, the first two records really, which I had. I was at the 75 Future Rock and Roll concert in London as a fan, And I remember coming back from it and thinking, I'm not sure he belongs to us anymore. That is the fans that knew him before that. He's probably going to be everybody's property now, because it was, I think we went along thinking only we knew about him, you know, and then suddenly it was a whoa, you know. And I watched that happen a couple of times. Bruce and I have talked about this in years past. I saw it happen again in 78 in Nashville. I was in Nashville to record with George Jones, and the record company took me to see him. I think shortly before Darkness came out, and the same thing. The audience knew Born to Run, but didn't know Darkness. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of resistant, and he had to state a huge case, and I wasn't entirely certain they were going to let him speak in that way, that it was already like, do what you did before, because we liked that, you know?
Right.
And I realized that even the greatest people have to make that, have to state their purpose. So it gave me a lot of impetus to do the same thing. I have to be honest, seeing that show in Nashville in 78, it made me think, oh, there's nothing to fear by changing gears. You got to keep changing gears. And of course, maybe the gear changes are sometimes more surprising, because people always assume you start and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and louder and wider and brighter. And of course, that is naturally the way it is. If you're being true to yourself, sometimes you have to go, what's down this road over here? Where does this lead? Oh, look, we're in a forest. You know, what's that in the tree? It's an owl. You know, look at the owl, look at its eyes, you know, and you're gone into that. And then you come back out again, and then where's the highway now? Oh, it's way over there. How do we get there? Across this field. Okay. And on we go. And then you're back on the highway, you know. And have you just gone down that straight track? You might have got bored.
Right. I was going to say, you would have missed all the scenery.
You would have missed all the scenery, exactly. And all the experiences and everything that you can learn. Took if you never went to college. Which, I mean, some people go to the college of playing repetitively and in the same bar over and over again. I didn't ever go to college. I didn't go to art school. Everything I learned was from travel, books, films, other people's records, you know, and things I overheard. And it doesn't make me smarter to say that I never studied in any formal way, but now and again, I had to stop and gather some skills so I could communicate coherently things that I wanted to do. And including, say, getting to the point that I could orchestrate North, or I could orchestrate Look Now myself. I didn't have to hand that over to somebody to misinterpret my intentions. I could write the horn arrangements. I could write the string arrangements. I knew where to leave the holes in Look Now so that it had the same kind of cohesion as a record that was arranged from the ground up, band and orchestra played live in the studio. I didn't want to do it that way, because I wanted to make sure that we got the best. Now, when it comes to a record like The Boy Named If, where we didn't even get to be in the same room, it was founded on immense trust between individual members of the band. That's exactly the same as being in the room with the Attractions. The first thing, we didn't know enough to mess it up. That's why this year's Model is a good record. That's why Spanish Model is a good record. Because we just didn't know enough to mess it up. We just knew how to play those things that way. We didn't have to play every other idea. But if we'd lied to everybody and said, that's all we know, would that have been better? I don't think so.
No.
I think you have to be honest and say, I also know about this, and here it is, and this is what this feels like. Now come with me here, you know?
You know, your father was a jazz guy, and you mentioned him in the these dance halls. Did that, his sort of background as you're growing up, did that provide any kind of foundation for you musically?
I think my father was a jazz musician by ambition, and then, like a lot of jazz musicians, realized there wasn't really a living to be made that could keep a family. And when I came along, he had to take a dance band job, initially as a trumpet vocalist, featured singer, and then became full-time a singer and didn't play trumpet for many years. And I did, when he was older, I talked to him about that. I took him to the Village Vanguard one night when he visited us, would be 16 years ago now. And, you know, I asked him straight out, did he ever regret that he didn't stay with jazz? Because we were sitting there Monday night listening to this incredible jazz orchestra, and it was just like, a dream to him to do that. Go to a New York jazz club and sit there and listen to like playing at the highest level. And I think he just realized that, it, you know, that his talent as an entertainer, you know, allowed him to make a living. It wasn't a very lucrative living, but he also had a very different relationship with popular music because of that, because the jazz musician would have been interpreting, would have been looking for interesting harmony on which to invent new things. Mm-hmm. That was the style of bebop, you know, was to expand the harmony. Instead of which he became part of this strange live action jukebox that was all of English music up until 1967, which was dance bands would play the hits of the day on radio broadcasts, regardless of whether those dance bands should have been playing songs by The Who or The Four Tops. That was just the way we heard music. We didn't have 24-hour pop radio. We didn't even have 12-hour pop radio. We had Radio Luxembourg, then we had the Pirates. You know the history of radio in England.
Right.
It's very different to the history. And my father was part of that process because he sang many weeks of the year on a lunchtime, Friday lunchtime radio show of an hour, in which he would be singing songs from the hit parade along with the other two singers that sang with the Joel Oss Orchestra. And bands, whether they be the Merseybeats or the Hollies, would come in and do a couple of numbers on the show. So I got to see both the imitation and the real thing. And in some cases, the real thing were also imitating records from America. So you, what are you seeing there? You're seeing a series of echoes, you know? And that affected the way I thought about songwriting particularly, because it seemed to me that the most important person in the equation was the songwriter, not the singer, because the singer could be anybody. The singer could be a local guy, could be a 35-year-old guy who's singing with a dance band, or it could be a kid who was 18, you know, but the guy who wrote it was Burt Bacharach or somebody, or Carole King. So that's why I think of songwriting differently to even some of my English contemporaries, because I didn't see the big surprise. I didn't see the big innovation in some of the songwriting or some of the music writing that went on in the late 60s that was supposed to be progressive, because I was aware of jazz records that I thought were way more progressive than that, that they'd been made in the 40s, you know.
Right, right.
And actually, some of them had been made in the 20s, and they were still more progressive than things that were being proposed by those dreadful hippie bands, you know. you ever listen to Louis Armstrong, you know? I mean, tell me that's not better than anything.
Well, I was certainly not going to argue with that.
Yeah.
Well, there was one thing I thought this was. How often did you play with your dad? And because I know there's this television commercial, this hard lemonade commercial, sometime from the early.
It's not hard lemonade. It's hard to drink, but it's not hard lemonade.
Lemonade
is alcoholic. no, it's just a regular soft drink.
Okay, a regular soft drink, and it's a. It's this commercial. It's like the band is rocking on stage.
I think it was made in 1974.
Okay.
And long, long before I had the Elvis name. And my dad, for whatever reason, was asked to... He used to do a lot of ads. He used to do a lot of studio work for ads and cover records under assumed names. So the idea of somebody having an assumed name was very familiar to me. He'd been doing it since the early 60s. So I never thought anything of it. I knew he had a bunch of aliases that he had appeared under, the Ravers, the Foresters, Hal Prince, you know, all these different names that he had appeared under. And they asked him, for whatever reason, to deliver this lemonade commercial as Elvis Presley. So oddly enough, the vocal is done in a sort of Elvis delivery while he and I are singing the background vocals like we're in the Swinging Blue Jeans. And it was my first recording session. You know, it was very thrilling to go into the studio, shoot it with my dad. I was playing the clubs myself by then. I'd had my little band in Liverpool for 2 years. I had another band in London around that time, and then they broke up and I became a solo singer and everything got rolling. But, you know, you're missing out. Like, if you're talking about family background, it's my grandfather who's the traveler. My grandfather was on the liners in the 20s. Coming back and forward to New York as a trumpet player.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The idea that you travel and play music and go to other places where they talk different and they have different clothes and different styles and they're on a different clock, began with that. And my mother, who worked in a record shop from the age of 14, had the same sort of curiosity about music, probably a much broader curiosity about music than my father, because when you're a specialist, like when you're learning an instrument, you narrow down on what it is you want to do with that instrument. But somebody has to, before computers, be able to recommend records to people who come in and simply start singing something to you.
Right.
Do you have a recording of this? And they're singing, I don't know, When the Red Red Robin Comes Bob Bob Bobbing Along or something, and they don't know the name of the song and they don't know who sang it. They heard it somewhere on the radio or in a dance hall. And they're going, do you have any recording of this? Maybe not a song even that recognizable, you know.
Right.
We have to know songs. So I think that probably broadened her interest in music, because she had to be aware of all the different types of popular song that were, all the different interpretations, classical music records that people would come in and hum a little bit of a Brahms sonata, say, have you got this? You know, which is the best version? And little by little, you'd gather some knowledge of that or of jazz music. And of course, you could also, in the same shop, they had like racks and racks of sheet music, because people still played music.
Right.
You know, they had pianos in their houses and they would want to buy the song copy so that they could play it. You know, so it's, I'm talking about in the 40s now, you know. So that's a long time ago. So that's the, it's not a superior education, but it's an odd education in music, isn't it? To be a child with an awareness of all of this in your own family. Other people have very, very extraordinary experiences as children, and they're brought up by incredibly talented musicians or artists. And other people are great with their art form because their parents didn't want them to do it.
Yeah.
That made them rebellious. And that's why they embraced the rebellious aspect, particularly of rock and roll, because they thought it threw off some of the conventions of parents who wanted them to do very, you know, stay with this kind of learning and thinking and kind of model for work or religious belief or something, and forbid that, you know, forbid that licentiousness. But I didn't have that in, you know, it was all on. So I'm lucky that way.
Elvis, we're only able to play one other track off the new album right now, and I'd like us to go out with Magnificent Hurt. How old were you when you first felt the Magnificent Hurt?
Whew. I don't know. I mean, when I look back now, I think it's easy to say, what year was Anyone Who Had a Heart? That's about 65, isn't it? Or 64 even. That made me feel strange, that music. It made me feel peculiar. Like, I guess it was a kind of erotic thrill in the music.
Mm-hmm.
The line in Girl, you know, what she told when she was young that pain would lead to pleasure. That was very puzzling because I was only about 12 when that song came out.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really aware of what that kind of paradox was. But you quickly learn, and so I suppose somewhere around there, it's the ill form. That's what the songs on The Boy Named If are a lot concerned, or you know, visit in different scenes, is that erotic thrill, even in the time before you properly understand your responsibilities or the power that it has over you. Magnificent Hurt, you know, you mentioned the storybook. I illustrated the storybook with various cartoons, very colorful cartoons, or daubs or whatever you would call them. And I was trying to think of a way to sum up Magnificent Hurt in in one frame. And I portrayed a couple on a roller coaster going upside down and their hair standing on end and their rings are falling off their fingers and their money's all falling out of their pocket. Because in the moment of desire, you lose all sense of gravity in every sense of the word, and allegiance and frugality. And, you know, you're wide open to wherever it takes you. And then you hit the splash on the way down. Sounds like somebody's knocking, say, stop that talking. I think that, So hence the crooked guitar solo in the middle, because you couldn't have anything else, could you? You know, you couldn't do a pretty guitar solo in a song like Magnificent Hurt. It has to be kind of twisted. So I got to step out on this one, and Steve gets to play around the riff a little more than he does on many songs of this simple form that we've taken. It's fun to play with the pieces, you know, paint in the primary colors sometimes. But you can also bring with you some of those little things that you've learned along the way, you know.
So I watched the cool video of this.
I mean, if somebody smart like you would know, would hear the little quotation from "I Want to Hold Your Hand" in this song, you know. But it's not, you know, there's a big difference between alluding to something in passing and building the whole song on that one simple idea and having no new idea to add to it, you know.
So I watched a cool video of the song. It's got these marionettes in it. Were you involved in the making of the video for
I was, you know, I mean, the artistry of marionette making is something that's very fascinating to me. I had some thoughts for the artist, you know, and he interpreted them the way he did. I think the hardest thing is really the freneticism of music is at odds with marionettes moving, because they move more deliberately.
Right.
And that, so they're almost like two times going on, which I love. That creates a little tension as well. And then we intersperse some illustrative semi-animated stuff, which I did. So it was really a collaboration at distance, because Tony, who made the marionettes, he was in England, so we were not able to be in the room. So in this, it was in the same spirit as the way the record was made. You know, it was made over distance. But between Tony and Paul Arlo Guthrie, who's a video editor from Minneapolis, Australian fellow, who's become a great pal, with whom I've done a lot of the visual work for both for stage performance and for the records from Look Now through Spanish Model, Hey Clock Face, and the French EP, which not to leave out, you know, we did an EP from Hey Clock Face, which was in French language interpretations. I love the idea of just making records that only exist in one place in the world, you know. And because I used to love those French records when they came out, you know. And then finally for this record, Arlo and I have made several clips. It's been a period of where we've had to be resourceful because of the time that we've had to ourselves, and now we're ready. We're in that preparation of getting ready to go out. We go out again in May. You mentioned August, but we actually go out in May.
Right, and in May, that's shows in the UK, or where are those shows at?
No, we began at Jazz Fest in New Orleans, which is, I think, the third or even the fourth time they've attempted to stage Jazz Fest. So we've been on the bill since the spring of 2020, and we've remained true to our engagement. And like a lot of bands, they're waiting for their previously rescheduled dates to be played, which is making the... You know, if we don't visit your city right now, it's because there's a huge queue of bands outside the door at the backstage. They're saying, hold on a second, before you come and play here, we've been trying to play here since 2020. And you just have to accept that. It's a big organizational nightmare for everybody to get back to any kind of rhythm that we recognize. But we'll do it as best as we can. We play I think I'm playing twice at Jazz Fest. I'm playing with my friends in the Dirty Dozen Brass Band in a tribute to Dave Bartholomew, which is long overdue. I did actually get to perform with Dave, which was an amazing thing. You know, the man.
When was that?
It was in 2006. It was 2005, actually. One of the largest of the it was the Big Apple for the Big Easy benefit. Mm-hmm. At Madison Square Gardens, which was then the biggest gathering of New Orleans musicians since people were forced out of town by Katrina and the subsequent disasters. And I played, both my wife and I played with the Dozen. And she did I'm Walking, I did The Monkey Speaks His Mind. And I played with Alan Toussaint there as well. It was.
Did you ever play with Fats Domino?
I never did. Oh. No, I never did meet Fats. But we will certainly be have him in mind, because I mean, Dave is an incredible producer and band leader,
right?
Trumpet player, songwriter, but you know, most of his songs were known in as sung by other people. You know, yeah. Many of them, Fats Domino. So
he was just a regular Nick Lowe of his time, I suppose.
Oh, well, he was, yeah, he was incredible, incredible energy. I mean, he came in. I remember he heard Dinah running through and walking. And then he said to her, can you play Body and Soul? Like, she wouldn't know how to do that, you know. Like, and then they were just playing for the next 20 minutes. He just played trumpet and she just played changes for him. You know, she just... That was just the rehearsal. That's one of my favorite memories. He just wanted to play.
Yeah.
He just wanted to play. And so it'll be good to, it's an honor, you know, to be part of that, to be invited in from the outside to something in the New Orleans community, because I love so many of the musicians. I've got good friends from there. I've had a tremendous experience of working with Al Toussaint.
So that's Jazz Fest. Are you doing other shows?
We'll
be playing, in April in States?
I'm playing, we're playing The Impostors will play the next day, and we will play at Jazz Fest, and then on the 6th, and then we go to Tulsa, and we're playing the Keynes Ballroom in Tulsa, which is part of the week of events leading up to the opening of the Bob Dylan Center. Mm-hmm. So Mavis Staples is playing two nights before us, then we're playing, and I'm sure there'll be other people performing. And then we're getting ready to go to England to open a tour in June.
Okay.
And we're doing a tour with our friend Ian Prowse, a great songwriter who I think listeners to this channel would really appreciate. Any fans of Bruce Springsteen would love Ian's songs. They're written with the same kind of big heart. He's got a new album out called One Hand on the Starry Plough, a song called Holy Holy River that you should check out. That should be your next most fabulous song of the week. That you should get Ian. His stuff is
well, you know, we got to get the great Durag one and all that. You know, we got to get the little Stephen to point that in his direction.
Which one?
The you were just saying that should be a fabulous Sora Coolest song. Yes. And I was just saying,
you should. I can recommend people all day long to you, but you probably know who you should feature. But you should definitely have Nicole Atkins on your show sometime and talk to her, because she's a terrific songwriter, and she's right out of Neptune City. You know, she's from out of Asbury and that kind of area. She lives down in Nashville now, and she did a record called Memphis Ice, which you should check out. It's a beautiful album. She took all the songs from her album Italian Ice and did them with just two string players and a pianist.
Oh,
and
cool.
It's so good singing. You've got to hear the singing. The singing is so heartfelt, and the whole story. And you know, sometimes when you get in the studio, I mean, this is one of the reasons why you take records on the road. So when you get in the studio, you have all those ideas.
Right.
And sometimes they're great ideas and everything comes real vivid. And then other times you cover up some of the secrets, and if you're lucky, you get to play the song again. And those secrets come out. And that's what I hear on that album, and it's what I hear in our shows. We jumble the pieces together, and we will be opening up, I think, in Grand Rapids in August and running right through to Las Vegas at the end, very, very beginning of September. So we're out for a lot of, I think we start around the first week of August. And we are traveling all around. We're coming to Pier 17 in New York. We are playing in Denver. We are playing at Wolf Trap. We're going up to Massey Hall in Toronto, where that has been under renovation and is now back open. And then no sooner had they got it open than they had to close it again because of everything that was happening.
All right.
So it's be terrific to go back there. So some of the shows are inside and some of them outside, some of them are in your neighborhood, some of them are out, you know, a little out of town, as the summer shows sometimes are, but people are used to that. And I mean, if you come and see Nick Lowe and the Straitjackets and me and the Imposters, they're in a better show coming to your town this summer. That's
oh, I know. That's right.
That's right. there aren't two better songbooks.
No.
From. I mean, Nick's got some.
And what I love, too, about this is that, you know, you continue to record new music, make new music, and that you have a desire to perform that music live, to do the traveling, to bring it to different places, to bring it to all sorts of different people. And that's just, you know, it's two different ways to interpret the music is, you know, yeah. You put it on and it's there in your room. And then it's another thing to experience with the person.
I appreciate you saying that. That's important because, you know, here's the thing. You don't know the future. And some of our favorite artists are out there playing and they're going into some territory that's never been seen before. Not in this kind of music. And, I can't see the future. I think I make each record as if it's going to be the last one. And with this one, I think that's why I put Farewell OK was going to be the closing track of the record. And then Sebastian said, why don't you make it the opening track of the record? They want to make people nervous. okay. And you know, I'm glad I did that because since we made this record, we put the old band back together and made another record. So you know, who knows when that'll happen, but you know that it's never ending if you don't want it to end. And so long as we can stay on our feet and proud of what we do and doing it right, then it seems to be a good thing. And you know, I was watching the Rolling Stones on television the other day. And there was this film about them being in Latin America. And I found it very moving. I didn't expect to enjoy it so much. I thought, well, I know what the Stones sound like. It was a tremendous thing because you could see so much how much it meant to all of the audiences where they saw them. Yeah. And I thought the band played as well as I'd ever heard them play. And of course, it was kind of heartbreaking to see Charlie just being so Charlie, you know, just he was so great. And, you know, you realize that then he's not there, and we were lucky to hear him play. And I said to Pete, now it's on you. You know, I hate to break it to you, but you're the best rock and roll drummer in the world now. You just are, and that's the end of it. And don't get big-headed about it, because he never has been, but you name me another one who's better, who's playing every day. I'm not talking about people by reputation in the past. And somebody will tell you, oh, there's some guy because he can do like a million of these things. And he's got, look how many symbols he's got. That's not what it's about.
No. In fact, I think there's a definite inverse relationship as far as rock and roll drumming goes and definitely. Numbers of roto toms, as you said, symbols.
Do you know how many of those Earl Palmer had? You know, I mean, that's it. I worked with Earl Palmer. You know, I got to be in the studio with him.
Oh, really? When was that?
King of America.
Oh, right. King of America. Yeah. Okay.
One session with Earl on drums and Ray Brown on bass. I mean, that was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. You know, that's why it's hard for me to be sentimental about a band that existed 40 years ago, because that was a great experience. But so was playing with Jerry Sheff, who played with Elvis Presley. So was playing with Paul McCartney. So was playing with Ray Brown, if only for one night, only for one afternoon. You know, Tommy Walk, you know, T-Bone Walk, who played on some of my records. I've been very blessed. And Davey Farragut now and the Imposters, along with Bruce Thomas, those are some of the best people who ever played the bass. And I tapped to the bass is the foundation. It sounds obvious because you say it's the bass. Of course, it's the foundation, but it's really, that's what makes it swing.
Yeah. Elvis, thanks so much for making this such a special Coolest Conversations today.
Thank you. Manfred, it's been good to speak with you. Anytime, you take care, and we'll see one another, I'm sure, in time.
Definitely, if not in April and August, I hope.
All right, man. Take care.
And now it's Elvis Costello and the Imposters off The Boy Named If with Magnificent Hurt. in Little Steven's Underground Garage. After talking in tongues, I began to preach. White falls from the branches, an apple, a peach. Hold on to me. There's a red alert. It's the way.
That was some of Magnificent Hurt from Elvis Costello here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Tracks off the new album, The Boy Named If. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Elvis for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Next time around, I'll be chatting with Micah Morris, who fronts the Denver-based band Fast Eddie. They've got a new album out now called Take a Look, and that's just what we'll be doing, taking a look and a listen. For your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.